So the title of the talk is Existence Packaged into a Fantasy Called Me. Existence packaged into a fantasy called me, or a dream called me. And I want to start by saying that, you know, the Dharma, we often have a very simple view of the Dharma, which is, it's not quite like that. The Dharma didn't say that there is not an experience of me. The Dharma did say anatta is that it has no enduring reality. It isn't a thing, but it's certainly an experience. And we can say there is a functional me, a me that is needed to function in the world. And the child grows up and needs to know the difference between a me and the world. Otherwise, the child will not be healthy. The healthy child needs a good me. I would say good enough me. A good enough self. Just enough to be able to survive and cope with the world. So, from this good enough me, the child or the adult knows how to act, has capacity, function, and survival. Because if we're not at all sure of any boundaries, we'll get knocked over by the first car. Like small children, actually, they need to be looked after because they don't have boundaries, so they can touch the fire or they can, you know. But what is a good enough me is very cultural. In the West, we really, since the Protestant religious culture of science and of self and of capacity and of doing and of individuality, we have a very strong sense of me in the West. But you think about American Indians or Aborigines in Australia, their sense of me is really different. They would have it, but it's much more integrated into the world around. I remember I wrote an article which appeared in Chaim Achirim about Aborigine. I met an Aborigine head of an Aborigine tribe, and we had many long talks in India, and I wrote an article based on the talks. And one of the things he said was that when one of the animals died out, became extinct in Australia, the Aborigine tribe, who identified with that animal, and that animal was in a way them, they became sterile. They couldn't have any more babies. The whole tribe died out because it was impossible for them to have children. When their animal that represented them died out, they were lost. They couldn't survive anymore. So this is a different view of self. It's much more integrated into nature, for example. Just sort of a point that we sometimes forget, that there's a cultural. And science or psychology or neurology would basically say that the self is transparent, meaning that we don't know that it's there. We actually don't know the self. In an ordinary person doesn't really know the self. The ordinary person would say, I am sick. Or, I believe in Jewish belief. Or, I think this. Or, I want that. And it's entirely automatic. There isn't a sense that of a subject that is saying that. It's just all transparent. The person sees through it, and you know, you just think about someone who's owning a car. Their ownership of the car is not something that they notice as a intimate experience of ownership. They just say, "My car, my wife, my husband, my children. It's just transparent. So just to be aware that unless we're meditators, we won't even know that the eye is working. But it's a functional eye that we all need. And in the Dharma, there is quite a lot of emphasis also, as in psychology, on having a better self, on improving the self, having a better life, being a better me, being kinder, more happy, more rich, more, you know, whatever we want for the me. So there is a, in the Dharma and in Western psychology, quite a strong message that the me needs to be fed. We need to feed it and get it better and polish it nicely so it shines. But yet, both in the Dharma and in the Western psychology, if the me gets too big, it is clearly a problem. And then you have someone that is thoroughly egoistic, puffed up, blown up. And Western psychology also recognizes that this is suffering. Western psychology will not recognize that even an ordinary self is got in it suffering. But we will certainly recognize that if the self is expanded or contracted, if there's too little self also, that this is needs attention. And in the Dharma, it is really, really important in the Dharma to get a better self. The Dharma does not just say we need to see emptiness. The Dharma says we need to be the best self we can. And for example, the paramis, the 10 paramis, are qualities of the self, or qualities of mind-body, such as joy, such as calmness, such as patience, such as mindfulness, awareness, such as energy or determination. They're all qualities that the self has that are encouraged in the Dharma. So Dharma doesn't sort of go, as my answer to you, it doesn't just go to a place of emptiness, a place of nothingness and so on. It very much also says in order to be released from the self, you need also to build the best self that you can. Because this is a helpful journey on eventual awakening. So, the self is a source of dukkha because it's disconnected, because it is separate, and its function is trying to control the uncontrollable. And that's the basic source of dukkha. If you want to have definition of dukkha in three words, it's the pressure to control the uncontrollable life. The pressure to control the uncontrollable. Habilti nishlat. And the self is doing this. The self, its main function is to create is boundaries between me and the world, so I'm protected. The self is busy with protection. The self is busy with separation. The self needs to know what the world will do to me. The self needs to run away when there is a car or there's violence or there's a disease. The self needs to manage things. The self needs to protect. The self needs... So the self is busy trying to keep the boundaries between the self and the world. But those boundaries bring dukkha, bring pain. Those boundaries of separation bring fundamental pain because we become separate from the world. And it seems a very obsessive thing. Like it seems... for all human beings, way, way, way beyond the good enough self, the functional self. It seems a really obsessive busyness with me and mine and what I need and what I have to have and my boundaries and protections, and we keep the world out there. We don't let it in. We maintain a very strong separation. I have to understand the world. I have to manipulate the world. I have to manage the world. I have to build walls. I have to, you know, it's become total busyness with separation. And the separation is fundamentally a gap between subject and object. A subjekt for object. And Krishnamurti said it beautifully. He said, the whole tragedy of human existence lies between the subject and the object. Beautiful quote. The whole tragedy of human existence lies between the subject and the object. And suffering, a lot of suffering comes from this, because fundamentally our separation is a prison. So we separate the knower from the known, the me from the world, the knower from the known, and we find ourselves in a bit of a prison. We are closed in what I need, what I want. It seems like that's what we're busy with, and from birth to death. And it's painful. We are so busy with ourselves, what I need, what I want, what magili, what I have to have, what I don't want, what I, there's what I'm, you know, all the time. What I know, what I don't know is frightening. What will happen is frightening, etc., etc., etc. So this is kind of classic Dharma. And and it's worth remembering that most of the busyness of the self, even in a way protection, is actually a desire for happiness. The self is trying to control the world to be happy, to stay happy. And it's an impossible task, because real happiness comes when we are in unity with the world, where we are totally with the world. Then we are totally happy. Nothing disturbs us. We're totally with the world. So it's somewhere or other the busyness of being a self is also a search for something perfect. We want to control life, we want to prevent disease, we want to prevent protection, things happening to us. So we're searching actually for happiness and perfection and shleimut. But we're searching it in the wrong place, because we're searching it through duality, through me controlling the world. Whereas perfection can really only happen when we and the world are one. Then there's nothing to be imperfect. There's nothing can hurt. There's nothing wrong anywhere. And it's really frustrating, because we're so busy trying to be happy, but we don't never get there. So the way forward is, first of all, as the Dharma always comes with an interest in the truth, firstly, and not in belief or in illusion. And so the first thing to do is to actually see that there is a separate self, and to really engage with the separate self, knowing it fully as it is. And this is the movement of anatta, of the three characteristic dukkha, anicca, anatta. Anatta is knowing the self when it comes and goes. And in some way or other, the Buddhist teaching will basically say no awakening is possible unless you engage with anatta. And I want to quote here a monk, Nyanatoliko Bhikkhu, who said, one cannot too often and too emphatically, in fact, you know, Dagesh, we have to really emphasize the fact that not only for the actual realization of the goal of nirvana, but also for a theoretical understanding of it, it is an indispensable, meaning you absolutely have to have it, preliminary condition to grasp fully the truth of anatta, the egolessness and insubstantiality of all forms of existence. Without such an understanding, yeah. one will always yeah. misconceive Nibbana, conceive it wrongly, according to one's either materialistic or metaphysical views, either as annihilation of an ego or as an internal state of existence into which an ego or self enters or with which it merges. They said it's really important. You can't progress, you can't understand Nibbana if you don't understand self, basically is what it says. And so, firstly, you have to meet the self. See it, how it is a source of dukkha. See the boundaries that we hide behind the walls of the prison. See how we constantly make a self. See how, because we have a self, the world then becomes disturbing to us. And we're constantly trying to fix the world, to control it. And this importance, especially in Dharma, is that the story of this yogi that came to the Buddha and said, I walked and walked and walked and walked and walked hundreds of kilometers, and I can't find the end of the world. Tell me how to finish this samsara, the end of the world, how to end all this suffering. And the Buddha said, in this 2 meter long body, with its perceptions and thoughts, I proclaim the world to be. The world is here, in here. Likewise, the origin of the world and the ending of the world, and the way leading to the ending of the world. I printed it big, because it's worth remembering. And the Buddha basically said it, we have to explore how we make the self and the world. It comes from our consciousness, the way we look at the world, the way we are in the world, the way we ourselves are. And if we want to end the world, basically to be liberated, we need to go into the way the self, this 2 meter long body, that makes the world, we have to look at it, we have to understand it. As Dogen said, the spiritual life is to see the self. To see the self is to be released the self, is to be free of the self. To be free of the self is to be awakened by the entire world. But kind of the first step is actually to see that there is a self that is giving us source of dukkha. And it's a deep habit. Here is a little quote that I just saw a few days ago from Winnie the Pooh. Piglet was busy digging a small hole in the ground outside his house. "Hello, Piglet," said Pooh. "Hello, Pooh," said Piglet, giving a jump of surprise. "I knew it was you." "So did I," said Pooh. So we need to see that. Paticca Samuppada, of course, the fundamental teaching of the conditioned arising of the self is the way we do this, is the teaching about it, and it emphasizes there how we become someone all the time, that the attachments and needs and desires and craving keep making us what we are and keep making the self the same pattern all the time. And so we need to see this, how we keep becoming ourselves, how we see what the power of it is. And the early teaching of the Buddha basically was teaching his first five students, who were his early friends, that in a way turned against him but then became his disciples. And the fundamental teaching right at the beginning that he gave to them was that if you can't control what happens to you, you can't control your thoughts, and you can't control life, and it does what we don't like, and it brings us suffering, then there's no one in control. That was the basic teaching. There isn't a self, because if there was, we could control what happens. And we can't. And we could make sure we have a good time. And we can't. So we're not in control. So it's an illusion to say that there's a self, because clearly the self doesn't work. It can't make things happen. It can't control thoughts. It can't control the aggregates, basically. It can't control perceptions. It can't control memories. It can't control consciousness. It can't control form. Form is arising. We're given a form by life. We're born into a body. We don't control it. We don't control anything. We try very hard, but it doesn't doesn't do what we want. And it also brings us suffering. So the Buddha said again, to his starting with his five disciples and repeating it all the years of his teaching, something that cannot be controlled, that does what we don't like and passes away, cannot be a self. And that he repeated all through his teaching life. Something that, and it's something that you can almost see with a theory, but also with practice. But even conceptually, you can see it. And, there's a text that, about how the self can catch us. People who look at the self without wisdom will ask, was I in the past? Was I not in the past? This is a sutta. What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what? What did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? In other words, what will happen to me? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what in the past, what shall I become in the future? Or else they become confused about the present. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? When they attend unwisely in this way, six possible views will arise. The view self exists for me arises as true and established, or the view no self exists for me arises as true and established, or the view I perceive self with self arises as true and established, or the view I perceive not self with self, or the view I perceive self with not self. Or else they have some other views. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, eternal, not subject to change. These views, bhikkhus, are called the jungle of views, the wilderness of views, the distortion of views, the prison of views. And controlled by these prison of views, the ordinary person is not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, and pain, and despair, and they're not freed from dukkha. So it very much the practice of looking, of engaging with self is seeing the self and beginning to understand that the self cannot be a thing that has any real substance. And no views about it are relevant. None of them are true. They're, in other words, when you look at the self, you see mystery. You see total uncertainty. And there is the beginning of anatta, of non-self. It's not about a belief in non-self. It's about trying to find the self and being unable to really catch it. And so the best way of looking at anatta, one of the best words to describe anatta is transparency, shakuf. Because we look at the self, we can't find it. We experience a sense of me, but if we look at that sense of me, where is it? How is it? What is it? What does it do? Where? There's a poem by Nagarjuna, you know, the famous Buddhist philosopher sage of medieval times. And he wrote a poem about anatta, among many, many poems about anatta, but one of them I'm reading here. And the poem is called Already. And it really twists the mind. All his poems twist the mind, but this one especially. Am I already here before I see and taste and feel? If not, how could I see and taste and feel? How can I know if I'm already here or not? It's beautiful. If I were here without them, tasting the senses, b'li chushim, they could be here without me. I reveal them, they reveal me. How can I be here without them? How can they be here without me? I am not already here before experience as such, because seeing reveals just the seer, tasting reveals just the taster, feeling reveals just the feeler. If I'm not already here before them all, could I be here before each one? Can the seer taste? Can the taster feel? Were they different, I would be multiple selves. Nor am I closed inside the elements from where seeing and tasting and feeling arise. If I, to whom these things belong, cannot be found, how can they be found? I do not come before them, nor am I with them, nor do I follow them. Let go of I am. Let go of I am not. Nagarjuna. The deep practice of mindfulness when engaging with the self shows us where we are and where we are not. Shows us the impossibility of finding a self, the paradox of it, the mystery of it, and yet we have an experience that I am here. And when we look at that experience, we can't find that experience. It isn't at all pointing us to anything. I am not the body. It's a classic practice, both in Dharma and in Advaita and in many, you know, and it would just go anywhere you want in the spiritual world. And for authentic spiritual teachings, even the Christian mystic, doesn't matter where you go. The knowledge that the body is not me, I don't own my body, is a route to awakening. And we discover that by deep mindfulness in the moment, that I don't own my body. What do I own? It was what we did in the meditation just before. What is it that I, can I say I really own my body? And of course this goes back to the aggregates. Can I say I own my consciousness? Can I say I own my perceptions? Can I say I own my, sankharas? And it leads to a deep stillness, a deep inner quiet, where selfing doesn't really happen anymore. And there, in this quiet, self and the world become one. And then there may be a movement, or a thought, and again we're self. And again there's dukkha. Here I am thinking about something. And then back into deep silence in which there really isn't any selfing. It's just the world and me, one thing. The character of that is silence, is stillness. The Buddha was always silent when asked about the self. He never, and there's plenty of texts that you probably know already, that say, you know, that where he was asked about the self, and he usually was silent. Because he said, if I say there's a self, when people ask me, I'm supporting those views that, and if I say there's no self, I'm supporting other views of there is or there isn't. So I think that when we go deeply into mindfulness, we become familiar with the self as it arises and disappears, and we become less interested in the self. The self just becomes less of an issue for us. It's not that we wipe it out, and sometimes anatta, people mistake anatta, just like the sutta, with a view that anatta is no thing, anatta is emptiness, and so on, and this can confuse. But in real experience of each of us here, anatta is much more the lightness of being, where the selfing, we can have an experience of a subject, and then it disappears into stillness. And the subject disappears and appears again. And we are free, even if the thought, I am, appears or disappears. So it's really allowing selfing to be much less interesting and controlling of our whole experience. And do take that home with you as a kind of a good message for your meditations and for your spiritual life, because it's not that we have to have a goal called disappearing, called non-self. It's much more that selfing arises and vanishes and moves and it's mysterious and we can't find it and it appears and it's dynamic and it doesn't control us. Because we are familiar with it. The way this happens to us is with mindfulness and non-attachment. When we see the way becoming a self happens, and then disappears. It arises in consciousness and goes away. Then we can be fundamentally not clinging to self. Selfing arises and vanishes. I am a subject of my experience and the next minute I'm not. And we begin to sort of be free. We see the world as appearances. We make the world. They're not reality. The subject is not a reality, so the object is not a reality. They're appearances that appear to a subject. Right now we're seeing things. We don't know what the reality is. Our eyes tell us this. Our mind, based on habit, tells us that we're all here together. Our ears are listening, but who can say what the reality is? It's appearing. There's a nice story, Zen story. You probably know it, about the empty boat, and it's the way that we're taking ourselves much more lightly is actually a really good protection in life. Because the story is that somebody was a passenger, wanted to cross a river, so he asked the boatman, "Can you take me across the river?" The boatman said yes. And in the middle of the river, they got hit by another boat full of people. And the boatmen shouted at the people, "You idiots, why did you not steer your boat properly? You bashed into my boat." They went on a bit further and they got hit again, this time by a boat with nobody in it, an empty boat. So the boatman said nothing. And the passenger said, "Well, why didn't you shout at?" And he said, "Well, there's nobody to shout at." The empty boat there's nobody to shout at. So our emptiness is a protection because we can find that there's nobody to shout at. We ourselves don't need to shout at ourselves if we see how empty we are. And that the self isn't such a thing. It's a dynamic, flowing, changing. So, awakening is about presence, about being present. Being is about being, is about totally in the being of world and my experience of it. Like the Buddha said, the ending of the world is in this 2 meter long body. What did he mean? He meant Nibbana. And Nirvana is the ending of the subject-object split. And because of that, awakening can never be personal. Awakening cannot be about me awakening, because it's just an absurd. The me is the problem. The me is believing in the me, and then, therefore, the world separate from the me, is the problem. So to say the me is awakened, it just doesn't work. You can only say awakening is happening. Awakening is just happening by itself, or it's just there, and the sense of freedom. And in that place, the knower and the known come together. They merge together. They come, the knower and the known, and in there's no real words for it, because all the descriptions we have of the world depend on duality of me and the world. So there's no descriptions left to describe how it is. And the Buddha talked about it as unbinding, unfinding, no descriptions, untying the knots. I'll read you a poem from sort of inspired some the Udiana, which is inspired Buddhist poems from the Buddha. Look at this world, beings. Hurt with thick ignorance, are not released from delight in what has come to be. All levels of becoming, anywhere, in any way, are passing, stressful, subject to change. Seeing this, with right understanding, one lets go of craving for becoming, without delighting in non-becoming. From the total ending of craving comes dispassion and cessation, nibbada, without remainder. And the word he uses, unbinding, untying. For the monk, unbound, through lack of clinging, there is no renewed becoming. He has won the battle, gone beyond all becomings. Suchness is the final word. Such. Kacha. Kahut. Such, it says. Such is also tat. Like Tathagata, the name of the Buddha. That. Just that. There's nothing more you can say. So I want to finish with also with a quote from Nisargadatta Maharaj, who said, "Wisdom taught me I am nothing. Love taught me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows." It's a beautiful quote. Yeah, yeah. So let's sit quietly for a minute.